This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today, we have the return of the king. First time with me for a long time, the original founding father, Sharad Kutan.
Oh, that's such a sweet... I was thinking he was setting Matt up for an introduction.
No. It's always an insult if it's going to be me. No.
Okay. Always a pleasure to be here, Cam.
All right. Sharad, older listeners might remember, is...
The original team, right?
The original team.
Shifa C2, yourself and me.
That's right. And we have also another return, Mr. Tech himself. I'm not going to say anything rude.
Oh, gosh.
Matt Armitage.
Thanks, Cam. I'm very happy to be here and not be insulted.
Right. Although I do believe, I'm not going to insult you, but I do believe that when I was away, there was a bit of culture show where Sharad kept getting your name wrong.
I wouldn't say wrong. It's just my name has many characters, and Sharad was doing his best to bring out all of them.
All the characters. Yeah, I couldn't say Armitage. And it was the weirdest thing. But I believe the brain works in mysterious ways, and so does post-production work. So I don't know if Daryl took out all the mispronunciation of his name. So you might be giving away something there.
No,
Cam.
That's not how we roll here. We keep everything.
Anyway, it's raw. So it's raw and real.
So that's Sharad Kutan.
It's on the street.
Sharad Kutan and Matt Armitage. And and our three topics this week will be: topic number one is, does it matter if technology makes us illiterate? Topic number two is splunking. Find out more in a moment. And finally, topic number three will be patriotism. So Matt always has notes, by the way, which are written in words.
Which are written in words because I'm actually not very good at thinking on my feet. So I do prefer to have the things in front of me. No, I was listening to a podcast this week about the way that the blind community is interacting with technology. So a lot of smartphones and tablets now have these functions where they will actually read out everything that's on the screen to you, or they will zoom to a very, very high level for people who have partial sight, so that these devices are now becoming the go-to devices for the blind community. And a lot of blind people are now not learning to read Braille. One of the reasons is the cost. Apparently, you can get something like 15 tablets for the same cost as it has as one Braille reader, one of the electronic Braille readers. And for something like, for example, the show I was listening to said, if you wanted to read Harry Potter, the complete series in Braille, that is 56 volumes. It's something like 10 volumes or so per book. So obviously, it's more cost effective. It's easier for people because they have this device in their hand. But the downside is that a lot of blind people are now not learning to read at all. They don't know how to spell.
Okay, so Braille. Can I just come back? You said Braille reader, so that obviously is a device. I thought Braille was read with fingers.
It is read with fingers, but you can get electronic Braille readers, which basically type everything onto a pressure-sensitive pad. So you can actually read, for example, a web page, and it will translate the text into something that you scan with your fingers.
Right. So you're still touching.
You're still touching the Braille, but one of those readers costs about, I think it's something like $8,000.
You know, this is not just the blind community. You know, if you use WeChat, I know it's very popular in China as one of those apps that you can sort of meet people on. You know. It has a voice function. And I've noticed that a lot of people give up typing out messages and just speak. They send little telegrams, voice telegrams to each other. And what that means is that, and I see this all the time, people have forgotten how to spell. Or they've reverted to a couple of hundred years ago when spelling was anybody's game. I mean, you could spell anything.
Yeah, you could do whatever you wanted. Right.
So
yeah.
They don't even know how to spell smiley face emoticon.
But that's kind of the point. We're physically replacing the words with pictograms because it's much easier to send someone a smiley face than to say, hey, I'm really happy today, because that's how many words. Whereas you can just send this simple smiley face and that gets the emotional content of the message across. So we're seeing this kind of same mirror in the sighted community as what's happening with the blind community. We're seeing people relying less on the written word. And as Sharad said, people are sending these messages. Your Snapchat, for example, people are using that to inform people about their life in these kind of, you know, 4-5 second video clips about their life. Instagram has just come out with Stories, which is a way of cataloging your daily life essentially in video and pictures. So we're moving away from this idea of relying on the written word. And at the same time, and I'm guilty of this as well, I listen to more audiobooks than I read written books.
But Matt, you are Mr. Tech and forward.
No, and
so you would say this is kind of cool. This is okay.
I wouldn't say it's kind of cool and okay. I would say that this is the way that we seem to be heading because we're a lot more reliant on digital technology. But again, if we lose this ability to communicate in the written world, once the electricity gets turned off, we are in a bit of a pickle.
Well, if it lasts for a long time, it could just be a temporary, you know, brownout. But I do think that there is an issue about, I mean, the long-term implications. And there's, you know, a writer, Marianne Wolfe, who's written about how reading transformed the human brain. I mean, the physiology of the brain, and that's been changing over the last couple of thousand years as we were introduced to writing. And so the question is, clearly the brain's not going to not in some ways adapt to this new these new languages and forms of communication. This is the question is, what is the consequence?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if we go back to the emoticons, for example, presumably for emoticons to actually work on a global level, they have to become a global language, and they will evolve some kind of structure and form and the rule base that will enable everyone, whatever their native spoken language, to actually communicate in this pictorial form. But as we also know, language also shapes the way we think. So if we all adopt this common written form, will that mean that we'll all start to converge in the way that we think as well? We won't have these kind of linguistic differences from nationality to nationality or culture to culture.
So that's the upside of it. But, you know, there's a downside is, you know, philosophy. You think of so much of philosophy is about dealing with language and definitions and the precision. And I think what I see happening also around me is people are so vague about things, you know, whether it's directions, because they're so used to ways, and all they know is left, right, left, right, left, right, and they don't know how to map. Basically, yes. Their brains have stopped learning how to map
and also
and
they
using
don't,
visual cues.
And not just that, they don't know street names.
Yeah.
But that's
Malaysia. No one knows.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean,
Rotherham Roundabout. That's all you need to know.
That's being extended out to other countries now. Mm. You would know, you know, left on Broadway and fourth or whatever. But now there's no need to know that because, like Sharad said, it's left here, walk forwards for 500 meters.
Yeah, mm.
and that's
know.
As much as you need.
Well,
to know.
I would just say, OMG. I was talking to a school teacher a while back, actually, before. The tech, well, it was in the age of texting as opposed to whatever we call it now. She teaches English here in a government school. And she was saying people will write in that texting language.
Yes.
And then when she then says, these young people, when she then says this is wrong, they say, well, no, I mean, no, it's not. It works. People understand. This is language.
Yeah, but what kinds of things can be communicated? So you're talking about levels of sophistication. Of course, you can say, let's meet around, you know, McDonald's before B4-5 or something like that. But you know, when you want high levels of...
Absolutely. But then will people want high levels of...
Well, you know, I think chances are the world's going to be cleaved into a lot of people who are semi-literate and then the elite who have a capacity to move between these different forms, different registers of language, and they are going to rule the world because they haven't given up on the idea that reading is important.
Okay.
I would concur with that.
Right. I think we should end with semicolon, close bracket? Yeah?
No, emoticon. You know, shock and horror, the one where the face is being held like that.
Oh, I use a smiley face with a pair of glasses that are like my own.
We can carry on like this. But we move on, though, to, I don't know, Sharad, what's the emoticon for splunking?
I don't know. Actually, I would you know, if I didn't choose plunking as a topic to discuss, I would have chosen Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin, and, you know, why she stuck with him for so long, despite his sexting. He wasn't using words. I think after a while, he was just using pictures. Okay, so, but I'm not, I didn't choose to speak about Huma Abedin and Anthony Weiner. We're talking about splunking because in a previous episode, many, many eons ago, I said I was going to Sarawak and I was going to explore the Mulu Caves, and I actually did. And I must say, I did all the easy stuff, which is walking on those. Actually, it's a beautifully maintained park. I mean, it's extraordinary. You might think you're not in Malaysia just because it's beautifully maintained. The people are nice. They've got things sorted. And it's easy. Well, it's really easy.
Oh, that's damn it. That faint praise. Oh, my goodness. Topic number three is going to be patriotism. We're going to have words with you, Sharad.
But anyway, there's just one thing that words cannot capture. And that's the extraordinary size and nature of the caves. You know, when they say it's big, you don't know how big it is until you are a miniature. You are dwarfed by the ceiling of the caves. And so when they say, oh, there are 3 million bats up at that ceiling, and you look and you see this tiny black patch, and it says, is that 3 million? And it's so far high up. And then, of course, when you learn more and more about the caves, how deep they are, how extensive. I mean, that's just, okay, all the big things, right? Longest, highest, deepest, whatever, whatever. And then somebody tells you how long it takes to form a stalagmite, a stalactite, what are these things? And then you see long, long periods of time in little bits of gravel and stone, a millimeter a year.
Okay, so two things, though, Sharad. One is, quickly, what is actually splunking? You just said it.
Well, splunking is just exploring caves, basically.
Yeah, is it?
Just,
cave?
Yeah, going,
it's caving, yeah.
Going underground, yeah.
And then number two is, so the thing that struck you when you were there at the Mulu Caves was time.
Yeah, there is that, because it's not historical time. You know, I was reading this book by Peter Frankopan called Silk Roads, and it's all about history and human civilization that time. This is geological time. Mm. And when somebody says to you, this massive column, you know, was made up of basically accretions over time, 1 millimeter a year, you're thinking, that's a gazillion years. I mean, you don't even know how to begin to imagine, because that is the embodiment of time. It's like this huge column, you know, stretching 20 feet high, and that was 1 millimeter a year. How many years did it take to make that?
But Matt, you're nodding appreciatively. You were there. Have you been there?
No, I haven't been there. I've been caving once. Ooh. And again, we did the easy part, but then we did a slightly less easy part where you have to kind of fit yourself through holes in water, which I really didn't like.
Mm. Claustrophobic?
Claustrophobic, yes, but also this sense that, you know, you're underground, you're trapped. And I think it goes back to this thing. We are creatures of the surface. The surface of the planet is where we feel at home. And we really don't know, whether it's under the water or under the surface of the land, what's going on underneath. We're not very comfortable with it. One thing I was reading recently was, it was only in 2013 that we discovered the biggest volcano on the planet, which is somewhere under the Pacific. Fortunately, it's been extinct for millions of years. I can't remember what the name of it is. They called it the Something Massive. It's named after the Texas University that discovered it. They originally thought it was three different volcanoes. And they've since discovered that not only is it the biggest volcano on our planet, it's actually one of the biggest volcanoes that's been found anywhere in the universe so far. So, and it is the size of New Mexico.
My goodness. So time and scale.
Scale is everything in this.
With caves. But Matt, you said we are creatures of the surface. And you know, instinctively, I feel that's absolutely, that's true. That makes sense to me. And yet, caves around the world show evidence that human beings have been in them. And not just surface caves, not just the mouth of a cave, but deep, deep, deep down. I mean, there are cave complexes in Europe where they keep finding them, and then they go deeper and deeper into areas where there's absolutely no natural light. And not only is there no natural light, but in order to get to a certain spot, you would have had to have gone through water. So how do you carry light? And yet there are human artwork in these places.
I think the Lascaux
paintings
aren't very deep.
No, they're not. But there are others that are.
Yeah, but I think also the point is that the water changes its course over time. Mm-hmm. So, and also the surface of our planet, which we consider to be a constant, obviously isn't. When you start looking at geological surveys and they take ice cores from, you know, hundreds or even thousands of feet down, because the surface level has been changing over time. I mean, there was the Grand Canyon was, you know, full to the brim with water at one point. You know, the what we consider to be the surface is always changing. So again, a lot of these caves might have been more accessible at a surface level at
and you can see
in the past.
That in this in the cave walls, because they will tell you, well, the river ran about that height at some point. You will see not sediment but maybe pebbles, and you see a whole vein of pebbles. The other interesting kind of connection between Splunkers and our sense of history, I read this in a recent issue of the New Yorker about paleontologists whose work requires them in some ways to get people to do this caving stuff, because they need... So one very famous American fellow who's now set up this big paleontological thingy down in South Africa, he used his kid at one point. He used his 10-year-old son. But, you know, for other projects, he's actually just gone and talked to Splunkers to help him in discovering bones.
Yeah. And these guys as well, I mean, they're very, very extreme. Some of them go on trips that take 5 or 6 days underground, and they take scuba equipment with them to get through these.
They
these
like
flooded
it. You
I mean, they love it. Yeah, they I mean, it's it. the challenge of it. But it is.
They're crazy people, I suppose. We're all in agreement there. But I'd say, for me personally, that sense of time and scale, it does make one think about one's own mortality. But personally, it doesn't frighten me in that way, though.
I feel it's very comforting.
And it's magnificent to know that it's all part of one grand continuum.
I think it's frightening sometimes to be inside it, but it's not frightening to contemplate it.
Yeah.
You know, when I finished the book, I told a friend of mine that I finished Peter Frankopan's Silk Roads. He knew him at university. Then he says, oh, you've just got a new fan in. And then he tagged me, you know, Sharad Kutin. And then I wrote to Peter Frankopan. I mean, I tweeted to him and said, you know, what is the place of the individual in this grand history that you have narrated in your book? I'm still waiting for a response.
Okay, what's the meaning of life? Tune in.
In 140 characters, could you just explain to me your particular take on the question of the individual?
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing the response. In the meantime, though, thank you for leaving us in a state of... I thought we were going to have the answer there. Anyway, so but in a moment, part three will be patriotism here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Sharad Kutin, and Matt Armitage. And...
you related to that tennis player, the Indian tennis player?
Vijay. Vijay.
Yes, I am. But I have been asked in hotels if I'm Indian before.
What?
Because they also had my name written down as Amritaj. They said, excuse me for asking, sir, but are you Indian or perhaps Anglo-Indian? I said, no. They said, then why is your name Amritaj? So,
okay. All right. We've got it spot on. So topic number three is patriotism. In light of the recent Olympics, Madeco was just the other day. I don't know. I mean, Madeco now, I'm not sure if that's who that encompasses, but East Malaysians and Malaysians too. And also a story that is coming out of America about a footballer who by the name of Colin Kaepernick, who is refusing to stand up when they play the U.S. national anthem. And he's saying, why should I stand up for a national anthem that is racist, that for a country that has, you know, subjugated black people? He is, I think, in some way colored. I'm not quite sure. And so
it's hard to tell when you look at his picture.
No, because I don't see color, Sharad.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah.
I think you can check in with your doctor about that.
And the other day I was going to the Petronas to fill up, and this fellow was walking out with a big smile on his face carrying a whole ton of these Malaysian flags that he was going to stick to his car. And I wasn't going to stick any to my car. And it never crosses my mind to do so. So I was wondering, am I lesser for it? Is he more patriotic for me than me because he has 10 and I have none? And also, I don't know, patriotism. Good thing, bad thing?
Well, but I think many people have, you know, weighed in on this, and there are tons of quotable quotes. You know, patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel, as one. Lin Yutang, the Chinese writer, translator, and philosopher, had one. Patriotism is nothing but the love of food that we ate as children. Oh, is one nice. Is that yeah. So a lot of it is about nostalgia, but a sense of there's it's this because the nation state is so indeterminate. I mean, so amorphous is an abstraction. What is it to love your country? You know.
But isn't it a beautiful thing to know that you're part of something far greater than yourself, yeah, that can offer you protection, that will take care of your kind,
and also then offer your body up in the service of protecting the nation, including dying for it. So
yeah, but if you're an 18-year-old boy, if male, I mean, you know, we're past that, Gerard. We're safe now.
I see. I just think that absolutely. I mean, I think especially the kind of emergence of the nation state has made the issue of patriotism particularly important, right? Because it's all about what is patriotism, but I think linked to this idea of the nation state. So I'm not particularly, I would say, patriotic. At least I don't, like you, feel compelled to have an outward show of patriotism. And in fact, when bringing up the question of the sportsman, that's a form of patriotism because he clearly takes issues in his own country, yeah, including race relations, very seriously. Well, if that's not a sign of patriotism, I don't know what
else. But the great Donald Trump, all hail, he said that this fellow should go and find another country that suits him better. But Matt, you're an Indian citizen.
I am, yes, very proudly.
you're British. I mean, like, for instance, the recent Olympics, Britain won like so many medals. And when I was living there, I think in 1988, for instance, they won 5 gold medals. This time, 26 gold medals. And does when you see these things, does this mean anything to you? Does it just spark anything in you?
Come on.
No,
I
don't feel a thing at all. I mean, when people come up to me and tell me, oh, England's been knocked out of this football tournament or whatever, my reply to them usually is, well, it's quite amazing they made it that far. You know, I don't feel those twinges. And I think probably because patriotism in the UK, or certainly when I was living there, was pretty much synonymous with nationalism. So,
which is a bad thing.
Which is a bad thing. Mm. I mean, I remember I was a bit too young for all the kind of the race riots of the 1970s and the early 1980s. But there was
I was there, Matt.
On the front lines.
Yeah, yeah. Brixton and such.
Yeah, Brixton, Toxteth in Liverpool, all around the country. I mean, there was a lot of conflagration. See, I can't speak today either.
Functionally literate.
Yes. But again, at the end of the 80s, the early 90s, there was this rise of the British National Party and the National Front. And again, there were these movements, against racism. And I remember going on student demos where we went to, I think, the BNP headquarters in Kent in South London. And again, that turned into a huge riot with mounted police. So when I see a British flag draped around someone, I immediately think of a racist skinhead. I don't think of the
So you,
the pride
you've been away a long
nation.
Time. I mean, we're not going to talk about Britain for too long, I know what you mean. I mean, I was there myself in the 80s. And so if you go back further to, say, the 60s, you'd have the band The Who,
yeah,
who would have their cover of the album, they'd drape themselves in the flag, perfectly good. And then something happened. And then now, though, it's come back again. The flag is now perfectly acceptable.
But I don't think it is. I think it's just that the racist movement has become much more accepted and much more mainstream.
Right,
and that's
right.
Why the flag has come into the come into currency again. You don't see the flag being used on the left in the UK. You only see it being used on the right.
Well, I mean, I think there's the other issue, of course, is, you know, what is patriotism? What is the nation state? I think patriotism is essentially engaging in a debate about what the nation ought to be, its aspirations, what its character, what values it should stand for. So all these kind of peripheral things, like whether you hoist the flag up, you don't hoist the flag, and, you know, whether you put a pin on your collar or a pin on the pin of the collar, you know, whatever it is, these are unimportant things. It's whether you are really indifferent to what's happening in your country or you are concerned. I think that really is the mark of patriotism. So again, like the Black Panther Olympians in the 60s, yeah. who when they took the podium for their medals, raised their fist. It's like, okay, I'm, you know, so there's an American flag. It's not customary to put a fist up in the air when the American flag goes up, but they did that as a sign.
Do you know what the interesting thing about that was? Because I actually looked at that picture again a couple of days ago. And what I noticed was, because usually when the Black Power salute was given, it's usually with the same hand. I can't remember whether it was left or right. Obviously, these two guys only had one pair of gloves between them, because one was a left hand and one was a right hand. So, you know, it was obviously something that was done very much.
Oh, it was the gloved fist, was it?
It's the gloved fist that made the
Black Power salute.
But with reference, though, to that famous image from the 1968 Olympics, and also this fella, Colin Kaepernick, I agree with you, Sherrod. I think that it is a patriotic statement in its own way, but there is a kind of understanding by the mass that patriotism looks like this, looks like whatever.
Absolutely.
And so when you step outside it, you're no longer included in the patriotic, you're no longer protected by the umbrella of patriotism. Yeah. So Donald Trump can say, go leave this country.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's this wonderful word, commodious. I mean, a friend used it to describe America as commodious. What is it? And what did he mean by it? He meant it was open. It allowed everybody to make claims on it. Mm. So the Pakistani-American parents who fought, you know, who kind of got into that big argument with Donald Trump, say, read the Constitution. I mean, and so, you know, this guy, I mean, you can't imagine, I mean, this country, that kind of a serious contestation over who has the right to claim this nation.
Yeah.
We're so much more narrow and exclusivist. And
that it's increasing every day. I mean, but people are being shaved off all the time. You know, longer entitled to claim and but speak for the country.
I think the interesting thing as well is the arbitrary nature of borders in the first place. I mean, we're basing our patriotism and our nationhood on these very, very tenuous little lines that often shift. What country is Crimea now part of? What country do the people in Crimea now belong to?
It was always Russian.
But precisely. And you look at an area like Alsace-Lorraine in France, which has moved between France and Germany however many times. Then you have all the Middle European states, Czech Republic, Slovakia. And again, until the 20th century, those countries had very little history of being independent entities. They were usually under the tutelage of one empire or another, and they would have nation status or patriotism stamped on them by that particular ruler. So I find it very
weird.
I know,
and I hear where you're coming from. I mean, Malaysia could have been a very different shape if the southern states of Thailand had become part of Malaya. And they could well have done.
Yeah. And also, East Malaysia could have opted to go with Indonesia.
Yeah, well,
you know, let's talk
about them. They're Malaysians too.
For me, I'm generally very hesitant to say on air that I'm not, you know, I don't practice these customs of, you know, outfit shows or displays of patriotism, because I know that people are actually pretty unthinking. And I think what patriotism often does is it's about mobilizing the mob. And that I can see where you're coming from, Matt, in terms of, you know, thinking of the British National Party or these kind of fascist or proto-fascist organizations as kind of using, oh, we British and what is it to be, you know, be pure British, whatever, as a way of defining in very narrow terms who gets to speak and who gets to live.
It is, but also, I mean, there's the fact that Britain in European terms is a bit of a mongrel. You know, it's had a lot of different countries come in and influence it. We've had German kings, French kings, Dutch kings. We've been part of the Roman Empire. We weren't part of the Roman Empire.
This is history on a geologic scale. You're talking about.
No. But that's what I'm saying. I think physically, because Britain is an island, it's maintained its kind of borders and its structure pretty much until the recent Brexit. And I think that's kind of helped that very long period of Britain being this pretty much one thing. It means I think people take it for granted a lot more than much younger countries.
Yeah, true. But fortunately, you're, Matt, now you're in a position where post-Brexit, Britain has elected to remove itself from history, and so therefore it'll never be a problem again. Personally, I'm a sucker for just about anybody's patriotism. I mean, if Tonga wins a medal in nose football, I'll be in floods of tears for them. And if, you know, Ngaruku is ever played and the flag is raised for, I mean,
I think you just failed the test of being a true patriot, because if you can't tell the difference between a Tongan and a Malaysian, though,
no, I'm
I think
saying,
Ridwan T just came out and criticized our Olympians and saying that, you know, using that horrible code word he uses, ultra kiasu, attacking our athletes of Chinese descent as being selfish. It's extraordinary what lengths people will go to say who's outside the group.
Ridwan T, and he strikes me as being such a
such a reasonable man.
Such a reasonable man.
Yeah, Kari Jamaluddin, also Minister of Youth and Sport, took him to task for saying that.
Oh, how sweet. So anyway, we move on now to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something we think might be of interest. And Matt Armitage.
Matt.
Oh, Matt.
Matt.
Yeah.
Matt.
Gosh.
Who's going to go first?
I'm going to have like some kind of complex at the end of this show. Yeah, I have just finished Porcelain, the autobiography of the singer, pop star, DJ, producer, Moby. It's basically a sort of talks about, and I listened to the audiobook, which is actually narrated by Moby. So,
read it or do you listen to it?
I absorbed the information. it was very nice because it was actually more about his time as a penniless DJ in New York in the sort of late 1980s and early 1990s. It doesn't concentrate so much on his superstar period. So it tells you a lot about the kind of color of the streets and, you know, the kind of nightlife and the underbelly of New York of that time without going into too much kind of seedy detail. One of the stories was lovely. He used to hang out with some of the drag queens, and he used to go to these things called Stevie parties, where all the drag queens would dress as their favorite version of Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac. So you'd have this room full of 300 drag queens all dressed as different versions of Stevie Nicks. And yeah, along the way, he meets Madonna and Miles Davis, who don't really think very much of him. It's just sort of nice and wistful and quite whimsical, actually.
Mm. Actually, I have read, there was a magazine, there was a big chunk of it in a magazine, and it's really very well written.
It is, surprisingly well. But he is the great grandnephew of Melville, the writer of Moby Dick.
No.
That's where he gets his, that's where he gets his name Moby from. Yeah, yeah, he's related to Melville. Yeah.
Wow.
Interesting.
Wow, okay. So the book is called Porcelain.
Porcelain, yeah. Named after one of his most famous songs.
And you don't need to know how to spell it, Cam, because you could just hear it. Porcelain.
That's right.
Yeah, you can go to Audible and dictate Porcelain by Moby and it'll download straight to your phone.
Seriously, Matt, did you read it or did you listen to
it? No, I listened to it.
Well, that'll be a subject for another episode of A Bit of Judgment. And so Sherrod goes next.
Well, I mentioned earlier Marianne Wolf. Her Proust and the Squid, which is that book about the mind and reading, is available on audible.com. And I started to listen to it, and I actually found it very difficult to follow the arguments just listening to it. Mm. I find that I need to read a book to follow complex arguments like that. Whereas if I was listening to a kind of, I listened to Brokeback Mountain or something, you know, the short story by Annie, not Leibovitz, Annie Proulx.
Okay.
Annie Proulx, I think, but spelled like Proulx, but... and Annie Proulx, and that's much more, that's easier for me, kind of fiction. This book, you know, because when you don't have a book in front of you, you want to wind back and you want to look back at the, and you might want to read it over again. Yeah. Sentences are complex and complex.
I actually find biographies work best in terms of
audible books.
Audible books, yeah.
Okay, so, and so therefore your recommendation is?
Is Peter Frankopan's The Silk Roads, because I think it's a stunning book, and you should take it when you go to my other recommendation, which is the Mulu National Park.
Okay, Frankopan.
Yeah. he's actually Serbo-Croat or Serbian or something like that. Mm. And he changed his name because his family was of some royal lineage. And then, but they hid the fact until the end of when Yugoslavia broke up, basically. Mm. Okay. And then they restored their titles themselves.
Okay, so my recommendation is, because I'm young and hip and groovy, and I've got my finger on the pulse, older listeners may know that I've kind of like lost touch with music, actually. And I'm desperate to always try to find something that I quite like. And I think I found something which is brand new to me, although when I did a bit of research, not terribly brand new. It's a woman, she's a woman, but she's in a band, and the band, but simply just her, St. Vincent.
Ah, yes, yeah. Annie.
Yet another Annie that stumps us.
Exactly, yeah. Yet another Annie. But she's actually been around for quite a while, a good 10 years, although I've only just recently discovered her. She plays a mean guitar.
She does. She's got a lovely collaboration album with David Byrne mm-hmm. from Talking Heads as mm-hmm. well. Yeah.
She won like an alternative Grammy thing. I mean, one hates the word alternative. But nonetheless, she is, in her career, you can see that she's morphing and changing and in the way that the great David Bowie did. So it sort of means something to me. And and I really like it, St. Vincent. And in fact, I'm going to ask producer Daryl if we can play out with one of her songs, which I believe goes by the name of Digital Witness. Very good, very good track.
Always on top of things, Cam, always.
Absolutely. Finger on the pulse of young people. So... that's my recommendation. I'm a little bit squeamish to do it because it feels kind of odd to say this, but young people music, good. St. Vincent. And so that brings us to the end of this week's episode of A Bit of Culture. Only remains for me now to thank special honored guest all the way from India, Matt Armitage.
Thank you. I'm heading back to my ashram now.
And...
that's a stereotype. All Indians live in an ashram.
No, just me.
Live in trees.
Just right. me.
Yeah.
I'm an ascetic.
All right. The brother of the great tennis player, Vijay. And Sharad Kutan.
Always a pleasure to be here, Cam.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us, please do so. Our Facebook page, the viewership on our page has gone up 700% because I believe 30 people looked at it last week. So also, Matt, you're all over the media, aren't you?
Instagram, the best place to catch me, at CulturePop.
With a K, isn't it?
With a K, yes. And no E.
And Sharad, you're...
At Sharad Kutan, spelled SHARAADKUTTAN.
Yeah. And you're like Mr. Twitter, aren't you?
It's the only... You know, but I did watch Facebook Live the other day because Julian Assange was on. And being interviewed by somebody from the New York Times.
Okay.
So, yeah, I appreciate advances in modern technology.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, thank you for joining us. Smiley face emoticons all over the place. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.